I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A top-secret Pentagon review panel is leaning toward a new strategy in Iraq. According to the Washington Post, top-level U.S. military members are reconsidering Iraq policy and are likely to recommend a short-term increase in troops followed by a long-term plan to drastically cut back the U.S. presence in Iraq. But there's concern that Iraqis might dismiss the idea as moonwalking out of their country. At least two other strategy reviews are underway in Washington, and former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger said over the weekend that military victory is no longer possible in Iraq. Joining us on the line is Pam Hess, Pentagon correspondent for United Press International. And Pam, apparently very few people who are involved in this Pentagon review are willing to talk about it. What are you hearing when it comes to the basic strategy options for Iraq?
The three strategy options that the Washington Post reported today, going long, which is basically sticking around for a long time, going home, which is withdrawing, or going big, which is a temporary increase, are the only options that we've ever actually had in Iraq. And sort of what struck me about this is that there are no new ideas under the sun. There isn't a silver bullet that's going to fix this. The notion of going big is almost a back-to-the-future strategy. It is doing what many in the military thought should have been done in April of 2003, which is going in with enough forces to establish order, to suffocate any of the so-called bad guys, and get things on their feet again. And the way that we're likely to see it, if that's what they go with, and it seems like their only real option now to actually change things, is an acceleration of the forces that are tagged to go over and a delay of the forces coming home that are there now. And I think that the maximum you would see that would be for about 6 months. You might see an increase of about 40 or 50,000 that way without having to activate extra troops to go over.
So do you think then that there's any common ground here between this review that we're hearing about in the Washington Post from the Pentagon, what the White House has said, and then the options that may come from the Baker-Hamilton Iraq Study Group and what that is supposed to recommend, I think, next month?
Yeah, I think that there is opinions coalescing in Washington about these three basic options, that withdrawal is pretty unsavory an option. I mean, if you can imagine, Baghdad is the size of about Los Angeles, and it's pretty much the Bloods and the Crips are in charge. There's 1,500 people showing up, killed gangland style, a month in the morgue. So put that into Los Angeles and think what would happen if you then pulled out all of the police. So that's not really an option. And many in the military that I've spoken to feel as though they have a moral obligation to stay and establish order or do their level best to do that before it becomes clear that they cannot, or if it becomes clear that they cannot. Going big would be a change from staying the course. They've tried just sort of hanging out with relatively stable troop levels, and that's obviously not working that well. So this is really the only other option. We're all looking to see what's going to come out of the White House and what's going to come out of the Iraq Survey Group. But really, it's an argument among the margins. General John Abizaid, he's the Central Command commander, told the Senate Armed Services Committee last week that an increase of 20,000 is not sustainable in Iraq because there just are not enough soldiers and Marines in the military to sustain a long-term increase of 20,000. That's been an idea that John McCain has had. Duncan Hunter, the outgoing chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, is going to have a press conference today where he will also talk about wanting to increase the troop numbers there. But for the military, it has to be a temporary increase because they really are feeling the stress of 5 years at war. 1.5 million people have been in the military that have gone through Iraq or Afghanistan in the last 5 years, and that's as many people as there are in the military in the active duty.
And just briefly, talk of the draft return to Washington. Democrat Charles Rangel said he plans to introduce a bill next year to return to the draft. What do you think? Will that help?
He's been talking about that for a long time. It's a political point he's trying to make, that people, if they think that their children are imperiled with the possibility of going to war, they won't be so quick to vote for war. I don't think it will go anywhere because practically the military cannot handle the influx of 50,000 extra new recruits a year. They just don't have the people to train them in order to keep up the quality. Those people that are training them are busy in Iraq and Afghanistan. So it's just an impractical idea as far as the Pentagon is concerned. And I think if you see a bunch of uniformed generals standing up and saying that Congress won't pass it. But Rangel's been trying to make this point for the last 5 years, that members of Congress, there's, you know, a handful of them have children that are fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Okay, Pam, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Pam Hess is Pentagon correspondent for the United Press International. We're going to spend a few minutes now talking about U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East with a man who's in a unique position to comment. Rami Khoury is editor-at-large for the Daily Star newspaper in Beirut, Lebanon. He's been a guest on our show before, speaking to us on the phone from Lebanon, but today he's joining us in studio. Rami Khoury, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Well, thanks for being with us. You've been traveling around the U.S. for a couple of weeks now. What are you hearing overall about U.S. policy toward the Middle East?
I think the most significant thing that I've noticed, and I've been giving talks and had meetings all over the country with university students and many other fora, there's a kind of perplexity. There's a questioning mood, and I think a little bit more humility in the United States, which has always been a good way to guide your foreign policy. People are wondering, why is this Iraq war in such a mess? Why do people criticize the U.S. all over the world? Why is the U.S. unable to get any traction when it tries to do Arab-Israeli stuff or Lebanon or Syria or Iran? It keeps running into resistance. I think finally the message is coming home to ordinary Americans and to the political class that the foreign policy of the U.S. in the Middle East is a mess, and it's getting worse, and the world is reacting to it. So I think that's what I'm noticing. People are looking for better analysis, better answers, better policy.
Would you say that the prevailing opinion then in the Middle East is that there's going to be a change because of this democratic takeover in Congress, or how would you describe the feeling overseas about what might be happening?
I think the sense is not so much that a change is coming in U.S. foreign policy because of the election results. I think there's a sense that a change is likely to come because the policy of the U.S. in the last 5 years has not worked very well at all, has been actually counterproductive. The U.S. is in a much worse position, and so are its allies, whether you're talking of Israel or its Arab allies. All of them are in a much more difficult position in the Middle East. So I think there's a sense that the U.S. has to start reviewing its policy in Iraq, which is the most urgent one, and you can't do anything in Iraq without looking at other things in the Middle East. So I think there's a sense, certainly I share it and some other people do, that if the U.S. is going to try to start pulling out of Iraq or doing something different, it must look at issues like Israel and Palestine, Iran, Syria, Lebanon, democracy promotion, all the big sticker items that the U.S. is dealing with have to be reviewed either sequentially or perhaps simultaneously if there's enough managerial and firepower and honesty in Washington.
Did you think that November's elections would help boost the credibility of the U.S. to be able to tackle some of those issues? Or is the credibility so damaged that it might be impossible for the U.S. to be able to do that?
There isn't a direct link between the election in the U.S. and the U.S.'s credibility. The criterion that people use to judge the U.S. is its policy and its impact. What is the U.S. doing? Not what it's saying, not how it behaves at home, but what is it doing around the world? And people, I think, broadly speaking, around the whole world, not just the Middle East, this is what's important, I think, for people in the U.S. to grasp. It's not just these nutty Arabs and Muslims and Middle Easterners who are doing all this criticism of the U.S. It's these Chinese and Europeans and Brazilians and people all over the world are critical of the U.S. And I think the policy is what drives the reaction to the U.S. So if the U.S. evolves and changes its policy, makes it a better policy, and a better policy meaning a win-win situation for everybody, for the U.S., for the Arabs, for Israel, for Turkey, for Iran. We're not talking about selling anybody out or, you know, people committing national suicide. We're talking about a win-win situation, which the U.S. Is in a position to help promote if it wants to. If it can do that, then it will find itself embraced eagerly by people all over the world.
Over the weekend, former U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger told the BBC that military victory is not possible in Iraq. What do you think a statement like that does? Does it reverberate and does it have lasting repercussions, would you say? Or,
well, it reverberates in the American political circles. I don't know why, because Henry Kissinger is not a man with a lot of foreign policy successes. I mean, if you actually track his record, it's not very impressive. he obviously has a lot of weight in the U.S. So I think it adds one more sort of a nail in the coffin of the current American policy, and will speed up the process of looking for a different policy.
Former Secretary of State Kissinger also said we need to bring other people to the table, like Iran and Syria. How important is that, would you say, to sort of stabilize the region right now?
I think it's very important, but it can't be the first process, and it can't be the main part of the solution, because the reaction you're going to get from me and many other people in the region is, hey, where have you been for the last 30 years when we, the other people in the region, were trying to tell you, the United States, that you need to solve the Arab-Israeli problem, or you need to stop supporting all these Arab autocrats and dictators? Where were you all these years? Now suddenly you're in trouble in Iraq, you need us, and you turn to us? There's a, you know, there's a kind of a neocolonial expediency and a certain duplicity and hypocrisy in that, which people in the Middle East won't put up with anymore. I think this is really the single most important thing that I've seen change in the Middle East in recent years, and you've seen it in Iraq, you've seen it in Palestine, you've seen it in Israel, Lebanon, Hezbollah, Iran, Syria, all over the place. People are no longer afraid of the United States and its main ally, Israel, in the Middle East. They're fighting back, they're defiant, they're challenging the U.S., they're defying it and fighting it sometimes politically or militarily, as people we just saw in Lebanon, Hezbollah is fighting Israel. There's a threshold of fear that has been crossed in this region, which people need to understand. And that includes people in the Arab world and much of the rest of the Middle East not putting up with the kind of duplicitous, hypocritical, expedient, and self-serving policies that the American and British and other Western governments have given us. And this is one of them, which is, oh, suddenly the U.S. is in trouble, talk to the neighbors. Well, of course, yes, do talk to the neighbors, but talk to the neighbors about what they want to help them be stable and dignified, as well as what's good for the U.S. And for Iraq. So it is an opportunity. We should do it, but we should do it with a sense of honesty and integrity that have not usually defined American policy in the Middle East.
How significant would you say was the visit over the weekend of Syria's foreign minister to Baghdad? Was that a significant move?
I think it was significant. Mm-hmm. I think it's a very important sign among several others that the Syrians have made in the last probably month or two, showing that they're actually quite eager to engage the United States, and even they're eager to engage in a peace negotiation for a comprehensive settlement with Israel. So I think it is an important sign. The United States should respond to it. I think what the most important thing we need now on all sides is a bit of humility. People should really, you know, stick their egos in their back pockets and just deal with this realistically. What are the real national interests of all of the key players, Arabs, Israelis, Americans, Europeans, Turks, everybody, Iranians? What are the real national interests, and how can we craft a process that responds to them all and requires concessions from all of them? And dealing with Syria is a critical element. Syria is a tough player. They play hardball. You know, they don't mess around. They have certain national interests that they want, and they have certain national aspirations that other people would object to, including, for instance, what do they want in Lebanon? You know, people are concerned in Lebanon that Syria wants to resume its control in Lebanon. And so there's issues that are legitimate, others that are contentious. But the only way to deal with them is engage them in an honest political dialogue, and not just dialogue, but trying to reach a policy that's good for all.
Rami Khoury is editor-at-large of the Daily Star in Lebanon. When we come back, we'll talk about Lebanon's role in Middle East peace. And speaking about Iraq and its neighbors, Iran has invited the presidents of Iraq and Syria to a weekend summit to discuss ways to reduce the violence in Iraq. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. We're back with Rami Khoury, editor-at-large for the Daily Star newspaper in Beirut, Lebanon. Before the break, we were talking about the possibility of the U.S. engaging in dialogue with Syria and Iran as a way to dampen the violence in Iraq. And Rami Khoury, you recently had a conversation about this with former Senator George Mitchell, who was chief negotiator in the Northern Ireland peace process. Do you think there are parallels with the Middle East?
I think so. I talked to him because I was so impressed by the experience of the United States in Northern Ireland, where it really was a fair and impartial and persistent mediator, and really came down right in the middle and didn't take sides, engaged everybody, including the IRA, who were terrorists, but the U.S. engaged them through the Sinn Féin. And a political process was crafted that worked, and the terrorism has stopped. The IRA's weapons have been decommissioned. There's a political process that's still being worked on. It hasn't fully kicked in, but everybody is working on it, and there's prosperity. And the real lessons are simply that any third-party mediator must be persistent and impartial. You can't have a mediator that comes down on one side or the other and tries to mediate between the both sides. That's why the U.S. and the Middle East has not been a successful mediator. So I think the lessons are important, and the Northern Ireland example is a real live reminder of the fact that the U.S. can, in fact, be an impartial and successful mediator if it comes down on the side of the rule of law and impartiality, and that's what we wanted to do in the Middle East.
Hmm. What about if we look at, say, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, though, and Hamas and what's happening there? Do you think that there can be a compromise with Hamas and Fatah, and do you think that that can be something that we can count on, and they could be a credible player in a peace process?
You mean the U.S. can be a player?
No, I mean the Palestinian government.
The Palestinians. Absolutely. Mm. I mean, they have to be. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict is the core issue in the Middle East. I mean, for instance, Hamas and Hezbollah didn't exist 20 years ago. They just didn't exist. They were born about 20 years ago out of the Arab-Israeli conflict. The Iranian president meddling in the Arab-Israeli and threatening Israel and wanting to wipe it off the map and all this nonsense that he says, this is something that didn't exist 20, 30 years ago. 35 years ago, the Iranians and the Israelis were in cahoots working with each other, sharing security. They were good friends and strategic partners. So the persistence of the Arab-Israeli conflict for so long has made the region much messier and more difficult and given birth to new political realities. So you've got to solve it, and the Palestinians are obviously one of the two key players with the Israelis. The consequences of the long-term Israeli occupation and its policies in Palestine are leading to some of the problems that we have, and the split in Palestine between Fatah and Hamas is a huge problem. Partly it's due to the incompetence of Fatah and Arafat over so many years, and partly it's the response of many Palestinians who've said they're fed up with this, and they're fed up with just pleading and waiting and begging, and they're going to support Hamas and take a more militant, hardline stand. At the same time, it's important to understand that Hamas is becoming pragmatic. Their positions on peace negotiations are evolving, and just last week, Hamas supported the Arab foreign minister's call for a new international peace conference between Israel and the Arabs. I mean, that's very significant. An international peace conference between Israel and the Arabs is something Hamas supports now. And I think the Americans and the Israelis and others who are more skeptical should really look at this much more carefully and see an opening here and go for it.
What about in Lebanon, where you're based? The leader of Hezbollah over the weekend called for protests against the country's government, saying that Lebanon's cabinet is basically a tool of the Bush administration. How would you describe the situation there?
What you're seeing in Lebanon now is the continuation of the summer's military war in a political domestic form in Lebanon. And what you're also seeing, I think, is the front line of what I'm calling the new Cold War in the Middle East, in which a constellation of forces on the Arab-Islamic Middle Eastern side, like Hamas, Hezbollah, Syrian government, Iranian government, some Arab nationalists, Muslim Brothers, populist groups all over the region, a whole constellation of forces is working together loosely or closely to confront what they see as the threat, which they see as the U.S., Israel, some Europeans, and some Arab governments and some Arab forces in Lebanon as well. So there really is a very new, a sharp confrontation politically, and it's being fought right now on the terrain of the Lebanese government, with Hezbollah and others confronting the elected the government of Lebanon. And this is a very important political struggle. As long as it remains political and peaceful, then I have no worries. Even if you have street demonstrations are perfectly legal, as President Bush said in Indonesia yesterday. There's nothing illegal about having peaceful street demonstrations. So, in fact, it's a positive sign. If Hezbollah is turning its focus into domestic Lebanese politics, I think people should be pleased with that. But they need to be engaged, and you need to have a real democratic process. So let's hope it continues like that. But there is a power struggle going on, and there will have to be a readjustment of the power balance in Lebanon.
Before we let you go, because we're running out of time, we'd like to get your thoughts on a couple of other things. What about the apparent growing anti-immigration sentiment in Europe? How would you say that that is is affecting things overall.
There's a sense now that Europe has shifted over to the American-Israeli side. Immigration issues, racism issues, the cartoons controversy, the European position on Iran's nuclear industry, the European response with the U.S. and Israel to boycott and starve Hamas-led Palestinians' democratically elected government, all of these things together, and the Europeans more or less went with the U.S. to delay the ceasefire in the Lebanon war. They gave Israel 2-3 more weeks to keep pounding Lebanon. There's a whole range of issues that let the Arab world feel that, well, maybe Europe is no longer impartial. And this is troubling because you need that European middle-of-the-road position as one that others can rally around, and we'd like to have a dynamic diplomatic Europe. But I think there is a change going on here, and one of the reasons is the backlash against the immigration. Europe is not like the U.S. It's not a multicultural society generally. Most countries tend to be monolithic, so countries like France and Sweden and the Netherlands, they're not used to having, you know, dark-skinned Muslim, African, Kurdish, Arab, Iranian people. It's new to them. The British have had it for a while, the French because of their colonial empires, but the others are having trouble dealing with this multiculturalism, different religions, different races, who are citizens. So it's a live issue, and I think it needs to be dealt with a lot more honesty and patience, and I think relaxation. People should relax a little bit and not get so emotional about these things.
All right. Well, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me. Nice to be back in Boston.
Rami Khoury is editor-at-large for the Daily Star in Lebanon, and he's director of the Ferris Institute at the American University in Beirut. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. In for Robin Young, it's Here and Now. As we approach the night before Thanksgiving, commonly believed to be one of the busiest bar nights of the year, Mothers Against Drunk Driving is unveiling a new plan to fight drunk driving. It would require those caught drinking and driving to have their cars equipped with devices that shut down the vehicle if alcohol is detected. Currently, New Mexico is the only state that requires such devices for first-time offenders, and the number of drunk driving fatalities in that state dropped nearly 18% in the year since the law was implemented. Joining us to discuss the proposal is Glenn Birch, president of Mothers Against Drunk Driving. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Can you start by just telling us a little bit about this plan, what it is, and who's behind it?
The campaign, and I am really excited about this campaign because we're going to use new smart technology, and it's in the development that will detect if a driver is drunk and prevent the car from starting altogether. Today, we've got technology. For example, we have anti-theft sensors in a car. We even have a car now that parallel parks itself. It's highly conceivable that we can have technology within the next 10 years that will have alcohol sensors to stop drunk driving altogether. But in the meantime, the technology that is we support right now is current technology, and that is alcohol ignition interlocks. And we would like to have the interlock placed on every convicted drunk driver. It's 90% effective, and also the public supports us in our efforts. 65% say they agree that a convicted drunk driver should have the alcohol ignition interlock placed on their vehicle.
So right now, New Mexico does have this requirement. So we've got 49 other states that need to be on board. Would you lobby for each state to do this, or are you talking about a federal initiative to try to get this?
We would lobby for every state. Mm-hmm. We plan on coming together with that model law. That model law will include not only that every convicted drunk driver have it, but it's placed on the vehicle and it stays on the vehicle until that driver is able to prove to us that he can drive safely and sober.
And how would that be proven?
Well, the tests. Each time he takes that test, it's documented. Today, if it's due to come off on Friday and he fails the test on Thursday, it still comes off. We want that device to stay on the car because he's proven that he's another threat to society. Mm-hmm. You know, driving is a privilege.
Is there a time frame, though? Like, how long would the device have to be on?
We're going to work with that with each state. Now, we want it coupled with treatment.
Well, Glenn, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Glenn Birch is president of Mothers Against Drunk Driving. Well, the idea of cars detecting the presence of alcohol may sound like science fiction, but that kind of technology and others like it are already in the works. True Touch Technologies in Albuquerque, New Mexico, for example, is currently developing a device that reveals a person's blood alcohol content by shining a light onto their forearm. And it doesn't end there. Jim McNally is president and CEO of True Touch Technologies. Welcome, Jim.
Well, thank you.
Jim, can you tell us a little bit about these kind of technologies that can shine a light onto someone's forearm and reveal their blood alcohol content? How does that work?
Yes. Basically, in the most simplest of terms, if you think about a flashlight, and if you were to take that flashlight, press it against the palm of your hand, and shine the light into your tissue, you can see some light coming out the back side of your hand at a little bit more of a sophisticated level. But basically, we do the same thing. It is a touch-based system where light from the near-infrared, so that's beyond the visible, not to be seen by the eye, goes into your tissue, and the light that comes back out of your tissue, we're able to process it and very specifically and accurately measure the alcohol concentration.
Would you have to have a very high concentration of alcohol for something like that to show up through the light, or
just be barely
over the limit?
No, it's very comparable, in fact, to the breath devices that exist today. We have done studies in clinical laboratories in which we've demonstrated that the accuracy of the non-invasive technique matches the accuracy of the existing breath devices on the market today.
What about accuracy? Yes, that the accuracy does coincide with the same as the breath devices, you said, yes?
That is correct. In our clinical studies, we've used humans, and we've done thousands of these measurements, in which we collect a blood sample as well as a breath sample. At the same time, we're making the measurement using our optical technology, and we show that we're as accurate as the existing breath devices that are useful today.
This light, where would it be placed in a car? Would a driver have to put their hands on something or their arm against something for it to shine through, or how would that work exactly?
Today's device that we have that we're about to put out on the market is actually a tabletop-sized device in which, as you mentioned earlier, we put the light in and out of the forearm, the underside of the forearm of the tissue. But there's nothing that prevents us from developing the probe in which one would then measure on the hand. Somewhere on the hand, either the underside of the palm or maybe the finger area, one would place the tissue in contact with a probe that could be ergonomically located on a dashboard, on the steering column, possibly on the gear selector. That would be up to the automotive engineers. Mm-hmm. And the person makes simple contact, touch-based contact with the probe, and then the measurement is made.
How do you ensure that it's tamper-proof to do what some folks do in the case of an ignition interlock where they have someone else blow into the machine?
That's a good question, and that's not a very unique situation where someone else blows into a device. We recently, unfortunately, had a terrible situation here in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where a mother in July had her child blow into the breath device. She was intoxicated, drove the car with her three children in it, and then had a terrible accident in which the child who blew into the device almost lost her leg due to the trauma of the accident. In our case, our technology not only measures alcohol concentration, but we also collect unique tissue properties. Your chemical and your optical structure of your tissue provides actually unique biometric. And so one is able to recognize when my tissue is placed in contact with the probe and the alcohol concentration is measured on Jim McNally. It also verifies that the tissue that was making contact with the probe is Jim McNally's.
How far do you think these kinds of devices are from becoming realities?
Well, we have an existing product today. Like I said, it's a tabletop product that would be used, say, in the law enforcement as you use breath devices today at the station house to collect evidence. It could also be used in office settings like treatment centers where they do high-volume alcohol testing. Our next phase of development is to develop prototypes where one is sampling on the hand somewhere and build up a prototype like that so we could demonstrate how accurately one measures alcohol in the hand. And I would say we are probably within 3 years of having devices ready, for example, as interlocks on those already convicted of the crime of drunk driving, and installing them in cars and starting the rollout of this technology in products that way.
Jim, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Oh, no problem. Thank you very much.
Jim McNally is president and CEO of True Touch Technologies. You're listening to Here and Now. It's the busiest travel season of the year right now, and the best advice for Thanksgiving holiday travelers is know how to pack and start exercising your patience muscles. Despite fare increases, authorities at major airports expect the volume of travelers to be about steady from the same 10-day period last year, but new Transportation Safety Administration restrictions on carry-on items are slowing down lines. Even a 10-second per customer holdup becomes a hassle when there are 60 to 120,000 travelers on a busy day. So don't even try to do the math. Just remember those patience muscles. And Khalil Sakakini, travel editor and consultant for GoTravelUpdates.com, is with us with some advice for making holiday air travel as painless as possible. Hello, Khalil, and thanks for being with us.
Hey, my pleasure. Welcome to the world of wishful thinking when you're traveling.
So what can we expect at airports right now?
You can expect long lines, frayed tempers, a lot of edgy people, and a lot of delays. With 25 million people hitting the road or hitting the airways, as it were, it's going to be a mess.
Oh. So how early should people arrive, and what can they do to make it less messy?
Right. It should be 2 to 3 hours ahead of time. But if you can get your boarding pass online through your computer, that's what I would strongly suggest. I mean, if you have checked bags, of course, you have to go through the lines, or in some instances, you can use the kiosks. That'll allow you to check bags and to get your boarding passes issued mechanically or electronically. But then you still got the security lines.
Right. And there's confusion, too. When you mention luggage, there's still some confusion about what can we bring, what can't we bring, what's allowed. What do you advise folks to do in terms of the restrictions?
Yeah, you know, the big deal today is the 3-1-1 rule. 3 ounces of liquid in a 1-quart see-through clear transparent plastic bag, and one bag per passenger. And that should be on the top of the luggage that you're checking through the X-ray machine. If you're putting your stuff in your check-in luggage, that's no problem. But liquids, gels, lip balm, deodorants, whatever, all have to go in that plastic bag, 3 ounces of liquid. But the important thing here, Deb, really, is that it's a 3-ounce bottle label. It has to say 3 ounces on the bottle.
So let's go through some of the items that people may be concerned about here. Baby formula is okay?
That's okay, as are prescription drugs.
Okay, those are both okay.
Right.
Bottled water.
Get it after you've cleared security.
Okay, saline solution?
Saline solution's okay, but that should also be in the plastic bag with your other stuff like that.
And let's talk about checked luggage when it comes to things that should or should not be checked.
It's a complicated issue because I would suggest checking your jewelry, checking your cameras, but then again, that raises the question of baggage theft. While not rampant, it's an issue. So my guess is leave it at home, and everything else you think is going to cause a slowdown, put it in the checked luggage.
Lock your luggage?
There are many different opinions. Certainly the TSA has come out now with a new lock, which only they can offer. And I think that that's probably a good way to go. Some people who don't know about that may lock their luggage and find that the lock has been broken because they need to inspect the bag. I would say in general, lock it. Better still, get the TSA new lock that's on the market now. And you know, I wouldn't put your, and I hate to be paranoid about this, your name and address on the ID card. People see that you are Joe Smith from such and such a street in such and such a city, know you're out of your house, and theory goes that they could go to your house because you're not there. Your name is certainly fine, and a phone number is great.
And what if you get bumped during this busy season? What should you do here?
Right. If you offer to leave, then you have no great intense travel plans. And obviously, you know, you will get overnight accommodations. You'll usually get credit for another flight, which could be anywhere from $200 to $500, which is usually good for about a year. For someone who has no tight travel plans, which is probably unusual during this Thanksgiving vacation, it's not such a bad way to get a free trip and see the city that you're departing from. Of course, they'll pay for the overnight accommodations and the meals.
Involuntarily bumped.
That's a tough one.
Right.
Yeah, that's a function of every airport's different rules and regulations, but typically you'll get very much the same thing. Credit toward, they'll put you on your next immediate flight. I mean, if you have to get there, they'll do their best to put you on the next flight departing for your destination. Failing that, to put you on the one the following day, but again, put you up and give you compensation for or credit for a flight in the future.
And be prepared to wait.
Right. Okay. Amen to that.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for speaking
pleasure.
With us.
Always a pleasure.
Khalil Sakakini is travel editor and consultant for GoTravelUpdates.com. We have links to the TSA website and passenger rights on our website at here-now.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now. Deborah Becker, it's Here and Now. How do you put a new twist on familiar family favorite meals like meatloaf and macaroni and cheese? Well, Jonathan King and Jim Stott, the owners of Stonewall Kitchens, a gourmet food store in Maine, have teamed up with Here and Now's resident chef, Kathy Guns, to do just that. Their efforts are shared in a new cookbook called Stonewall Kitchen Favorites. And here to tell us more is Kathy Guns. Nice to see you again,
Hi,
Kathy.
Hi, Deb. Nice to be here.
You say in this book that you looked for old childhood favorites.
Well, we didn't have to look because these are the kind of classic dishes that never leave you. In other words, even though food trends seem to change every few years and everybody's always looking for the newest, wow, what's great now, these were the foods that we never let go of. But what I did with these recipes was I kind of pared them down to the skeleton. I kind of took a look at them. And I said, what is it that makes this a dish that has survived 10 food trends? You know, Nouvelle, Japanese, Korean, Mexican, why do we still love certain foods so much? So pared it down and then gave it a twist. So if you take a Waldorf salad, remember that with the gooey mayonnaise and apples, and it was like, ew, but yum. But what's the yum part? That was my job on this book. Like, what is it that we love about this? So I roasted beets instead of boiling them, and I add fresh ginger to the vinaigrette, and it's got a thin slice of pear and fresh fennel. So suddenly this 50s kind of gloppy mayonnaise dish is really light and colorful and crunchy and completely appealing.
Oh, it sounds wonderful.
And it still does homage to the old Waldorf salad. We just got rid of the glop.
Was there a dish that you didn't really care for it all before, and then once you did, then,
well, the Waldorf is probably the best example.
Right.
I'm trying to think what else. I never was that fond of meatloaf, and the three of us sat down and we all started comparing childhood memories, and these sessions became very sentimental and sometimes sad because we've lost parents, but they made us really hungry. And one of the things that kept coming up was meatloaf. Like, oh, we ate meatloaf as kids. Oh, you're kidding, so did we. Oh, my mom put bacon on it. Really? My mom put ketchup on it. And then I went home with all these memories and created a brand new dish called Three Moms Meatloaf.
Well, I wonder, did you also think that you might have to put a twist on some of these? Because even though they're old standards and they may have withstood the test of time, a lot of people now have more sophisticated palates. So you do have to sort of bring it up a little bit in a way to keep it popular. Right?
I think that that's very true. But on the other hand, everyone I know, after they've had a bad day, what they want is comfort food. And they don't want it with too many fancy flavors. They don't want truffles in their mashed potatoes. The kind of food that you crave at home, we tried to talk to that craving, the craving for the day, you know, something bad happened at work and your romance broke up, and you want those foods of childhood. And they're just a bit better now.
Well, you know what? It's about family favorites, and we are going to taste, lucky for me. But we also thought we'd try out some of these with three young friends of the Here and Now family. So joining us in the studio right now is 10-year-old Martin Weisgerber from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hello, Martin.
Hi.
Also with us is Tate Mitchell. She's 9 years old, and she's from Brookline. Hello, Tate.
Hi.
And Noah Miller-Medson of Belmont, Massachusetts. Hello there, Noah.
Hi.
Okay, you guys are our testers, and Kathy is our chef, and she is going to tell us exactly what you have on the plates in front of you, and then you can try them out for us. How does that sound?
Good.
Okay, guys, are you hungry?
Yes.
All right, I hope my favorites become your favorites. Let's start with these funny little things. These are like potato chips, but they're made with something called a parsnip.
What do you think?
They're good.
What
good?
Is it? How does it compare to a potato chip?
It's kind of more sweet.
Parsnip chips get thumbs up?
Yeah. Even though they're not supposed to talk with their mouths full, you know.
That's right. But we're breaking all the rules today, guys. Okay, next on your plate, macaroni and cheese. It's a little bit different than the kind in the box because, A, I made it by hand. B, it didn't take a long time. And C, it has all kinds of yummy cheeses in it.
Well, a couple of forkfuls.
You love it.
Tate,
it's
you love it.
It's better than the stuff in the box.
All right.
Yeah.
This is called macaroni and four cheeses, and it has fresh thyme in it. Martin is going nuts. He's on his fifth bite.
What do you think, Martin?
It's better than anything.
It's better than anything. Really.
I love this kid. I'm taking him home. Okay, next on your plate, we get a little more sophisticated. I don't know how you guys feel about spinach, but this is called Mediterranean chicken, and it's stuffed with spinach and goat cheese and black olives and sun-dried tomatoes.
You can taste it without the spinach if you don't like spinach.
Okay. Noah's diving in. He's my guy, man. He's going for the spinach.
Spinach is actually good with the chicken.
Oh, excellent.
Do you not like spinach usually?
I don't like spinach when it's separate from everything else.
Oh, but in the chicken, it's yummy?
It's better than usual spinach.
Tate, what do you think of it?
I like the chicken.
You like the chicken?
I like the gooiness of the chicken.
You do? Good. You like the goat cheese flavor, maybe. Mm-hmm. Why don't you all help yourself to one of these? This is a chocolate and raspberry panini.
Oh.
A panini is like a grilled sandwich, like a grilled cheese, but this is like a dessert one. Will you pass that down, Noah? So this has yummy chocolate chips and fresh raspberries on crusty bread. Go ahead, guys. Take a bite of that.
Can you use your fingers?
You can use your fingers. What a polite child.
Now, the chicken's amazing. So it's not really just meatloaf or macaroni and cheese. We get a little bit. We get a little bit adventurous.
There's all kinds of things. I mean, the cover of the book, we have a lobster BLT. That's one of the favorite sandwiches. And they're wonderful soups. One of my favorites around this time of year is a roasted winter vegetable soup. Mm. You know, that's not from child. But it's kind of a take on the old vegetable soup we all ate out of a can.
Right.
Well, how's that dessert, guys?
Good. Really good.
I got a thumbs up. She can't talk.
I can't talk with my mouth full.
You taste the chocolate and then you taste the raspberry.
Now, Noah, you actually like to cook a lot, right? You cook already.
Yeah.
And how old are you?
I'm 9.
You're 9 years old and you cook a lot already. So what's your favorite on your plate today?
I have to say the mac and cheese.
The mac and cheese. Okay, we've got a vote
for
mac
the mac and cheese.
Tate, are you usually a big eater, a picky eater?
Usually picky, because I don't really like basically anything except for all this stuff.
Except for...
I'm taking her home, too. Okay, my family just doubled.
And what's your favorite?
Macaroni and cheese.
Macaroni and cheese. All right. Martin?
I have two. The macaroni and cheese and the dessert.
And the dessert.
I agree.
Now, what do you usually eat for dinner, Noah? You have a mouthful. How about you, Tate?
I usually have, like, tofu and carrots.
Tofu and carrots.
And peas. Like, all plain stuff.
So would you like it if you had something like this for dinner? Macaroni and cheese and the chicken and the parsnips?
But this is a little too much for my mouth.
The sun-dried tomatoes and olives and spinach is a little bit too much. But the chicken is good.
Yeah.
Martin, how about you?
I eat very different things because my parents are, like, Asian nuts, so they eat Asian food all the time.
Well, thanks very much to all of you for being with us.
You're welcome.
And I just want to ask Kathy something right now. Now, you know, a lot of people don't have a lot of time, especially when they have kids and they have jobs and all of these things. Do you think overall that this is complicated to whip up for dinner?
Some of these are definitely Saturday night fare, but I would say that more than half of the recipes, you could shop and cook and eat it within an hour, because the reality is that nobody has more time than that. I mean, we all love to eat, but we don't seem to have any more time than that. So we need things that are going to be really satisfying on many levels, but not take much more. So, yeah, you could do it.
All right. Great. Well, thanks so much, Kathy.
Thank you, Deb. Thank you to all you guys. Good eaters.
Thank you.
I don't think you are a picky eater.
I don't think you're a picky eater either. We've been talking and eating with Noah Miller-Medson and Tate Mitchell and Martin Weisgerber from Massachusetts. Also with us is our resident chef, Kathy Gunst. Kathy's new book, written with Jonathan King and Jim Stott, is Stonewall Kitchen Favorites, Delicious Recipes to Share with Family and Friends Every Day. Thanks again to all of you for coming in.
Thank you.
And for recipes or to see pictures of our special tasting panel, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.